I shan't be rethinking moral status as much as I shall be de-thinking it, in the sense of thinking it away, so to speak, trying to undermine it. In this talk, I shall discuss the relations between moral status and what I call moral significance. Something has moral significance just in case it in itself provides a moral reason. I shall argue that the moral status of something is dependent on what is morally significant about it. Nothing can have moral status if there isn't anything morally significant about it. On the other hand, something can be morally significant even though nothing has moral status in virtue of it. The notion of moral significance is therefore a more fundamental notion, and one we can't manage without. By contrast, we can't manage without the notion of moral status, and I think we better do so. Walter sort of directed our attention yesterday to a quotation from David de Grazia, where he says that the concept of moral status is redundant. I must have read this work by David, because I've read a fair amount of his stuff, but I was probably sort of thinking, oh yeah, and not realizing that one day I'd be sort of trying to de-think or deconstruct a notion of moral status myself. So I hope this what I was saying won't be too familiar to you. All right. Suppose, contrary to what I believe, that there could be free-floating experiences, that is, experiences without subjects having them, Humean bundles of experiences, of pleasure and pain, enjoyment and suffering, and other positive and negative kinds of experiences. Then the existence of such experiences would plausibly be morally significant. That is, there would be a moral reason to bring it about that the world contains more experiences of pleasure and fewer experiences of pain. But it sounds wrong to say that these experiences have moral status. Or suppose, which I believe to be true, that one way of making the world a better place would be by bringing into existence beings whose lives contain a surplus of pleasurable experiences over painful experiences. Then the possibility of such beings coming into existence would be morally significant. There would be more reason to to realize this possibility. But we shouldn't say, I think, that such possible beings have moral status. For that would suggest, misleadingly, that possible beings exist in a sense in which they don't exist, that they exist in space and time, whereas their existence in this sense is merely possible. So this is the first point on my handout. It says, I sort of thought it was more convenient for you to have the points on the handout, because you will have all the 10 points in view, and if I were to make a PowerPoint, I would just sort of, it would look like this handout split, divided into 10 slides, so it would be pointless. Anyway, that's the first point. Something can be morally significant, can provide a moral reason, even though there's nothing that has moral status in virtue of it. Right. These observations give a clue to a necessary condition for having moral status. In order for something to have moral status, not only must it be particular in the philosophical sense, something that exists in space and time, we also expect it to be something concrete and tangible, like an organic or conscious being or inanimate thing, well, bearing sort of angels and people, stuff like that, which we're not very well acquainted with. By contrast, what has moral significance is rather a property or feature of this being or thing in virtue of which it possesses this status, and which in itself provides a reason for how this being or thing should be morally treated. It's natural to take the moral status of a thing or being to be some sort of value or worth that it has. When something has value, it must have value in virtue of some other properties. Then it's commonly said that the value of the thing supervenes on these other supervenient properties that belong to it. This implies that if something else were to have these supervenient properties, it would have the same value, other things being equal. But if it's necessarily true that the value of a particular supervenes on some of its properties, the value doesn't irreducibly or non-derivatively belong to the particular in all its concreteness. If a particular P possesses a value in virtue of having a feature F, then we could in principle whittle away all the other features of P without removing its value, since its value is based only on its possession of F. Ultimately, it's this remainder that has more status, that is a thinner particular than what we commonly suppose. For instance, it might be just parts of a brain minimally sufficient to sustain consciousness. So that's my second point on the handout about the being the particulars that have moral status is thinner than beings or inanimate things. As regards what are morally significant properties that could provide moral status, a familiar idea is that among them we find a capacity for sentience, a capacity to have pleasurable and painful and other kinds of positive and negative experiences. While what I've said so far is about how the notion of moral status is what I've said so far about moral status is intended to answer the analytical question about how the notion of moral status should be understood. But this claim about the capacity for sentience being a possible ground for moral status is a more substantive claim about what features could provide something with moral status. I shan't defend any such morally substantive claim, but merely explore the implications of some familiar and more or less plausible candidates for being grounds for the analysed notion of moral status. It's a plausible idea that the fact that beings have pleasurable and painful experiences is a morally significant fact, because having these experiences is intrinsically good or bad for these beings. Treating beings morally well or badly could then consist in seeing to it that their capacity for sentience is exercised by their having such positive and negative experiences. It seems natural to think that what is morally good or bad from an impersonal point of view, is related to what is good and bad for beings, what is personally or perspectively good or bad. The simplest way to do this is the basic utilitarian idea that what is best from a moral point of view is the greatest net sum of what is good for all beings. But if this kind of reasoning is correct, then in order for something to provide for a capacity for sentience to provide moral status, it must be exercisable. The capacity for sentience must be exercisable. That is, its owner or bearer must be in external circumstances such that the capacity can be exercised in them, or such that moral agents can transform them into circumstances in which they can be exercised with their help. For instance, a capacity to see is useless if we are in conditions of permanent darkness. In order for this capacity to be of value, we must be in external circumstances in which we can exercise this. There must be light. So a plausible example of a morally significant feature is the feature of a capacity for consciousness, at least sentient. But this capacity must be exercisable by the subjects having experiences that are good or bad for them. I think Francis was sort of touching on a similar point yesterday in connection with David's talk. The fact that a capacity for sentient must be exercisable implies that the moral status can't be an internal feature that belongs to the being itself, apart from its relation to external things. If, say, beings whose capacity for sentience are exercisable on Earth were to be irrevocably deported to another planet on which these capacities aren't exercisable because the beings would be permanently unconscious, these beings would no longer have any moral status. They would be as good as dead. In other words, by taking having an exercisable capacity for sentience to be a property, the instantiation of which by a being grounds its moral status, we would include among the status grounding morally significant properties a property that's not internal to its subject but external to it, involving certain circumstances external to the bearer of the status. This makes talk about particulars moral status somewhat awkward, because the fact that this status is moral suggests that we are dealing with something that belongs to the particular in itself, and so to speak follows it around, whatever its external circumstances, as long as the internal properties are intact. For instance, it has been objected to viability outside the womb as a proposed basis for the moral status of newborns, that it's dependent on external circumstances, such as the equipment of a clinic where the newborn is delivered. Other kinds of status and moral status aren't like that. For instance, political status. You could acquire by being elected president, could disappear if external circumstances such as the election is declared invalid. So in order for the capacity for sentience or consciousness to be a ground for moral status, I think we need to stress that it must be exercisable. And similarly, if we were to extend it to potentiality, the potentiality would have to be actualizable. But this is something I won't go into. So this is the fourth point on the handout, that whether capacity for consciousness is exercisable depends on factors external to the bearer of capacity, and thus an exercisable capacity is not internal to the bearer, and so it's not an internal feature. Right. A more extensive class of beings that are endowed with moral status would result if the property of having organic or biological life were morally significant and sufficient for moral status. This class of beings would be more extensive because, although being alive is apparently a necessary condition for having an exercisable capacity for sentience. it's not sufficient, and the existence of as the existence of plants and various microorganisms show, the considered extension of the class of beings with one status would include these would include these organisms as well, if it's sort of understood in terms of what has biological life. The proposal that the property of having organic or biological life seems to be a property that belongs to an organism in itself, for it consists in such thing as having a metabolism. But as you know, no doubt, many have argued that it's difficult to understand why the property of being biologically alive should be morally important. For instance, I mean, that it's hard to believe that it's morally important that humans or other animals in a persistent vegetative state go on living. The proposed extension of moral status to biological living creatures raises questions. However, we've seen reasons to stretch the class of status generating morally significant properties to properties that aren't internal but extend externally, like the property of having an exercisable capacity for consciousness. This feature is however only extrinsically valuable for a subject. What is intrinsically valuable is exercises of this capacity by having positive experiences. But the capacity is still morally significant because in itself it provides a moral reason for seeing to it that this capacity is exercised by having positive experiences. Now, we've just seen that the property of having organic life might be a necessary condition for this capacity for having experiences. This would also make the presence of organic life extrinsically valuable for the subject. Would this feature therefore be morally significant? No, I don't think so, for by itself it doesn't provide a reason for promoting organic life. There being a moral reason to promote organic life depends on the contingent fact that there is also the distinct phenomenon of an exercisable capacity for having experiences, for which this property of having organic life is supposedly necessary. It's the exercisable capacity that's sort of morally significant. Right, so this is the fifth point, that the presence of an exercisable capacity for having positive experience is only extrinsically valuable, but it's still morally significant since in itself it provides a reason for seeing to it that this capacity is exercised. Biological life is not morally significant, for its extrinsic value derives from its support of this capacity. Right. Another biological candidate for being morally significant is the property of being a human being in the sense of being a member of the biological species Homo sapiens. But as many have argued, perhaps most famously Peter Singer, this speciesist idea is implausible. It has been suggested that lurking behind speciesism is the idea that the ground for the higher moral status of human beings is not their species membership itself, but the more advanced mental capacities characteristic of human beings. Capacities for self-consciousness, rationality, morality, and for long-term planning and so on. Let's call these capacities personal capacities, and the beings who are equipped with them persons, as opposed to the sentient beings who are equipped merely with a more humble psychological capacities of perceiving and feeling and having desires with respect to what they perceive and feel. It has often been claimed that in virtue of their possession of exercisable, I would say, personal capacities, human beings have a more elevated more status than sentient beings. But it's also been pointed out that one noteworthy implication of this approach is that beings who are not biologically human could have as high a moral status as human beings, since the personal capacities could occur without a biological and genetic underpinning that makes someone human. But it's another implication that I think is more important in this context, namely that not all beings who are biologically human will have the same elevated status, since they don't all possess personal capacities to the same degree. Some of them have these capacities to a higher degree than others, and some don't have them at all. Of those who don't actually have them, some have the potential to develop them, whereas other human beings are so disabled that they don't even have the potential. It follows that not all humans have an equal moral status, as might be true according to the radical form of anthropocentric speciesism. So we're facing a problem of an apparently endless variability of moral status, even among human beings. Whenever we have a moral reason to treat one being better than another for its own sake, there is a case for saying that the former has a higher moral status than the other one. This means that we can't categorize groups of being into those that have the same moral status. I mean, Tom said yesterday, he talked about 46 levels or degrees of moral status, but I think we would rather need 46 billion levels of moral status, because there's not only the fact that there are different species will have different mental capacities, is also the case that there would be within most species and a great variety between various kinds of individuals. because, for instance, in the case of human beings, no two human beings would have precisely the same mental capacities, and the length of their lives would also differ, and that's something else that could be considered to be morally significant. So I think we would sort of face this problem that the notion of moral status is useless for this purpose of categorizing. Of course, there are some people who draw a sort of magical line somewhere and say, so it's sort of supposedly obliterates all differences above the line and all differences below the line. So they would say everybody who's above the line would have the same status and everyone below would have the same status. But I haven't seen any good justifications for such magical dividing lines. All right. As a result of their more sophisticated mental capacities, persons have further features that aggravate this problem of the bewildering variety of moral status. Plausibly, persons are subjects of desert and can be held to be deserving of being treated in ways that are better or worse for them. This arguably requires that they can be held responsible for intentionally or knowingly performing or trying to perform actions that have good or bad consequences on themselves and others. Such agency is also an external feature of a person, which involves a reference to external circumstances like exercisable psychological capacities. If desert is morally significant, the moral value of outcomes is determined not only by how much or what is good for and bad for individuals they contain, but also by the extent to which these individuals deserve what they receive. Desert could aggravate the problems of the endless variability of moral status, because it raises questions like, if some persons deserve blame and punishment, could this lower their moral status below the level of other persons who have comparable mental capacity, perhaps even to the level of sentient beings? So the introduction of dessert will further complicate this matter. This is the seventh point on the handout. But some theorists deny that the applicability of the concepts of desserts and other concepts, the concept of dessert and other concepts, could make it just that some are better off than others, and maintain that justice instead requires an equality of welfare. Roughly, the idea could be that if there's nothing like desserts, that could make it just that some are better off than others. Justice requires that all be equally well off. But even if that is so, the consideration of justice requires that all be equally well off, that doesn't imply that the moral status is the same. That, for there are still differences between individuals by reference to which moral considerations other than justice, for instance, considerations of utility, could tell in favour of inequalities between them. It might be held that in virtue of their greater psychological capacities, there's a moral reason to treat some better than others, because they would then contribute more to goodness overall by making others or themselves better off. So this is the eighth point, that if justice demands that individuals be equally well off, it doesn't follow that their moral status is the same, for they can still differ with respect to properties which are morally significant for other, notably utilitarian reasons. Right. According to standard deontological theories, it's harder to justify morally harming innocent and non-consenting people as a means to a good end than doing so as a foreseen effect of the good end. This would be another morally significant feature when the rights of such people are violated by their being harmed. But does it affect their moral status? Well, Frances seems to think so when she argues that what she calls inviolability is victim focus rather than agent focus. And she argues that since it, quote, doesn't focus on what I do rather than what others do, the fact that if I kill somebody, I would be acting now and the victim would be mine doesn't play a pivotal role in my explaining why I must kill him. His right, not my agency, constitutes the moral constraint. The fact that the other five people have the same right doesn't diminish the constraint as against violating the one person's right that I come up against. But I wonder why Francis maintained that I come up against only the constraint against violating the one person's right, and not only constraints against violating the rights of the five people whom I could save by killing the one. Presumably because I'm facing the option of killing the one. Presumably, she makes this claim because I'm facing the option of killing the one now, as opposed to letting the five die. But the fact that I have the relation of killing to one and the relation of letting die to the five seems to be an agent-focused consideration. It has to do with the agent rather than the victims. It may be that If I don't save the five, they are killed as a means by some other agent. But it's hard to say but it's hard to say how it could affect the status of the victims, whether they are killed as a means by me or by somebody else. It's more plausible to hold that it could affect my status as an agent. But even if we sort of accept that the stronger consent is against harming and violate rights as a means is agent focus, and not a matter of the moral focus or moral status of the and not a matter of the moral status of the victims, it could be morally significant. So let me briefly summarize what I've been sort of breezing through rather quickly. The first claim I've made about the relationship between significant, morally significant features and their relationship to moral status is that the notion of morally significant feature is more fundamental. And in some cases in which such features are instantiated, they don't seem to make up the moral status of anything. This is illustrated by by the fact that it may be morally significant that a world can be made morally better by the creations of beings who will lead lives that are morally good for them. Additionally, there's a possible moral significance of the distinction between harming as a means to an end and as a foreseen consequence of the end, and between acts and omissions, which don't have to do with the moral status of victims. Prima facie, it seems that the moral status of beings must be based on some internal feature of the bearer, but its most plausible basis, for instance, possession of exercisable capacities for some form of consciousness, are features that involve relations to something external to the bearer. Moreover, internal features of the bearer on which the moral status depends form only a minor portion of its properties. Finally, the attribution of moral status raises a spectre of there being endlessly many degrees of moral status, since the exercisable psychological capacities that are the most credible basis of moral status vary endlessly among persons as well as among sentient beings. This problem is further aggravated if the concept of desert is allowed to enter the picture. Now, none of this implies that we can't truly make some simple claims about moral status, such as that there being beings who have moral status, and that the moral status of some of them is higher than the moral status of some others. But these claims don't take us very far and could easily be dispensed with by claims like that there are beings such that benefiting and harming them is morally significant, and benefiting and harming some beings is morally more significant than benefiting and harming others. By contrast, a concept like that of a morally significant feature is indispensable, and to use the concept of moral status as well seems to complicate matters unnecessarily. Right, so that's it. 35 minutes.